From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is visiting Minnesota public radio station KNOW for a few days. I'm Marty Moscowain. On this edition of Fresh Air, thoughts on the GOP of the future. We talk with Senator John Chafee of the moderate Republican Majority Coalition and Ralph Reed of the conservative Christian Coalition. Both say the party isn't in such bad shape as it looks forward to the 96 election. Also, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Lewis Puller. His book, Fortunate Son, is about his father's military career as well as his own. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews The Dutchman, a historical mystery. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq's representative at the United Nations has delivered his country's official response to the Allied demand that Baghdad remove its anti-aircraft missiles from the area south of the 32nd parallel. Ambassador Nizar Hamdoun said that Baghdad rejects the legitimacy of the zone itself. It wasn't clear whether that response was also a rejection of the Allied ultimatum, which now leaves Iraq less than 24 hours to withdraw its surface-to-air missiles. Wire service reports quote Pentagon officials as saying that the missiles have been moved, but darkness and overcast weather have made it difficult to tell where they've been taken. Israel says it will allow the Red Cross to visit more than 400 Palestinians who were expelled from the occupied territories. The men have spent the past 3 weeks in a frozen no-man's land in Lebanon between territory controlled by Israel and that controlled by the Lebanese government. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The Israeli announcement came just hours before a second United Nations envoy arrived in Israel to investigate the situation of the exiles. Israeli officials say they have not changed their fundamental position that the Palestinians will not be allowed to return. But the announcement to cooperate with the Red Cross is seen as an Israeli concession to international pressure. Previously, Israel had said it would allow the Red Cross access only if Lebanon agreed to provide the exiles with food and medical care. Lebanon is still refusing, but Israel said it decided to allow the Red Cross to visit the camp once as a goodwill gesture. Red Cross officials hope to make the trip tomorrow, weather permitting, in a UN helicopter. Meanwhile, the UN envoy, Chinmaya Gera Khan, will hold talks with Israeli officials tomorrow. He will also visit Lebanon. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Republican members of the House of Representatives have filed a lawsuit challenging the recent expansion of the voting privileges of five House members. NPR's Korva Coleman reports.
Last Tuesday, the House expanded voting rights for five of its previously non-voting members who come from four territories and the District of Columbia. The measure granted them the right to vote in the House's Committee of the Whole, which is made up of all members, but they are still barred from voting on a bill's final passage. Republicans unanimously opposed the measure, calling it a Democratic power grab. All five non-voting members are Democrats. The GOP argues that no one is permitted to vote in the Committee of the Whole or on a bill's final passage unless he or she represents a state. The non-voting delegates insist, since they already can vote in committee, they should be able to vote in the Committee of the Whole. Republicans hope to resolve the lawsuit within 60 days. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 36 points to close at 3,269. Declines led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR. A senior U.S. official said today that the Arab nations appear determined to remain outside the International Chemical Weapons Treaty to be signed next week in Paris. Arms negotiator Donald Mali said that he expects that all the major countries of the world, except the Arabs, will sign the agreement next week. The treaty would ban the production, stockpiling, and use of chemical weapons. A spokesman for the League of Arab States said that the 20 members of the group will withhold their signatures until Israel agrees to remove all its weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. During Senate confirmation hearings today, Robert Reich, President-elect Clinton's choice to be Secretary of Labor, pledged that he'd preside over a Department of the American Workforce dedicated to nurturing the country's most important national asset. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Reich outlined his goals for the Department of Labor, which reflect the ideas he's championed as an author and lecturer at Harvard. Those goals include better training and career prospects for American workers, particularly the 75% who don't graduate from college. Reich has written that American workers are the only element of U.S. production that can't be relocated in a global economy. He argues that investing in those human resources will ensure that companies keep high-skilled, high-paid jobs in the United States. Reich said that despite press reports to the contrary, he has not backed off the Clinton campaign promise to get companies to spend 1.5% of payroll on worker training. Senators praised Reich's ideas and predicted his 25-year friendship with Governor Clinton will put the Labor Department at the center of the new administration's economic councils. I'm John Idstein in Washington.
The Gannett Company announced today that it's selling the Honolulu Star Bulletin to a Florida-based partnership. The afternoon newspaper is being sold to Liberty Newspapers Limited Partnership in Destin, Florida. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. The Republican National Committee is meeting later this month to elect a new chairperson and to rethink its platform. Bush's loss has forced Republicans of many ideological stripes to reevaluate the direction of the party and the issues it wants to champion in the coming elections. My guests on Fresh Air represent two different points of view within the party. Ralph Reed is director of the Christian Coalition, which was founded by evangelist Pat Robertson after he lost his bid for the presidency in 1988. The coalition advocates a mix of conservative social and economic policies. They support choice in education, tougher crime laws, a reduced tax burden, and oppose abortion, gay rights, pornography, and sex education in schools. Senator John Chafee is a Republican from Rhode Island and a member of the Republican Majority Coalition. The coalition was formed after the election by moderate Republicans who want to win back party members turned off by the conservative social agenda of the religious right. I asked Senator Chafee why he thinks President Bush lost.
I think, like every situation, there are a variety of factors. I will say I think the Clinton people were superb in portraying the country as being in the most dismal fiscal and economic straits has ever been in, and you might think we're in the depths of the 1932 Depression to hear that the portrayal that the Clinton people did very successfully. The facts are that we're in a recession, but it wasn't anywhere near as severe as was portrayed. But for every individual affected, obviously it made a difference. But I think that the programs that President Bush had underway and that are now bearing fruit are showing that this country was not as severely depressed as pointed out. So that was clearly the economy was a major factor. There's no getting away from it. I also believe that there were a whole slew of voters across the country who were working. After all, if there's 7.5% unemployment, there's 92.5% employment. And there were a whole group of people across the country that had voted Republican in past years that voted Democratic because they really were put off and distressed and, I suppose, in the extreme case, frightened by what took place as they saw it in Houston. The idea that there were certain family values, which seemed to be a code word for denouncing all pro-choices, for denouncing everything to do with homosexuality, the gays and lesbians, the very words that come sometimes use Christian coalition. I don't know where that left anybody who was Jewish, for example. And I just know of many, many, many people who just said, this isn't for us. This isn't our party.
Mr. Reed, let me come back to you. And do you think the Republican convention in Houston turned voters off against Bush and the Republican Party?
No, there's no objective evidence of that. I think what has happened was not what actually transpired in Houston that turned off voters, but a spin that has been put on the Houston convention by the media, suggesting that it was a hate fest, that it was a display of intolerance, and in fact it was no such thing. My boss, Pat Robertson, spoke at the convention. He didn't speak in prime time. He spoke about 7:20 in the evening. But he didn't talk about homosexuality or abortion, and he didn't gay bash or anything like that, and there was nothing intolerant in his speech. He talked about term limits. He talked about reducing taxes. He talked about family tax relief. He talked about the end of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall coming down, Operation Desert Storm. He had a beautiful discussion of being in the Sudan with Barbara Bush in 1985 and seeing her feeding starving children. It was an uplifting, positive, inclusive message. And the fact of the matter is that if you look at the speakers that spoke at that convention, there were 50 speakers. It included Lynn Martin, who's a pro-choice Republican on the cabinet. Who can forget that moving speech by Mary Fisher, the AIDS victim, encouraging everybody to reach out to people who are victims of AIDS, regardless of their sexual preference? I mean, that was in there. You also had Pete Wilson, pro-choice, moderate governor from California, speaking in prime time via satellite, and I could go on and on. There were many. There was a whole diversity of views expressed from the podium, and no one was excluded. In fact, that's what made Houston such a contrast to what we saw in Madison Square Garden when the Democrats had their convention.
Well, Senator Chafee, let me come back to you. And would you agree then with that characterization of the convention? I don't want to spend too much time on the convention because I want to talk about the future and the present, but just to give you a chance to come back.
I think that what you've got to remember in conventions that who looks at them at what time. And clearly the Pat Buchanan speech coming just before the president was a very, very choice time, was one of the most significant time spots in the convention. And I think that, I haven't heard comments on Pat Robertson's speeches, but I think it was the Pat Buchanan speech where in the course of maybe 15 or 16 minutes he mentioned gays three times. Just totally unnecessary, and I think that was the type of presentation that was turned off. So different from Ronald Reagan, who I think gave the best single speech at the convention, and that Ronald Reagan doesn't spend his time on things like that. Ronald Reagan has a much more gentle approach to him, and that was one of the keys that where Ronald Reagan was able to hold that coalition together. Clearly, if the Republicans are going to prevail, these are the people that we've got to get back into our tent, the so-called Reagan Democrats, who believe in so many of the things that we believe in a strong defense, believe that their government shouldn't interfere with their lives, believe in lower taxes, believe in individuals making choices, believe in the encouragement of individual initiative. These are the things that we've got to accent. I think it get tangled up with these issues like school prayer or no abortion or trashing of gays and lesbians, as Pat Buchanan did in his speech, just gets the Republican Party nowhere.
The Republican National Committee is meeting this month, late this month, to elect a new chairman or chairwoman. What issues are on the table, you think, for the Republican Party? And I'll put that to you, Mr. Reed.
You mean in terms of the future of the...
Yes. Yes.
I think that the Republican Party needs to get back to the central and fundamental rationale for conservative governance, and that is jobs creation and economic growth. What happened here was the Reagan coalition was a three-legged stool. It was foreign policy conservatives who were concerned about a strong national defense. It was social conservatives concerned about strengthening the family, and it was economic conservatives concerned about lower taxes and limited government. When the Cold War came to an end and the Berlin Wall came down, those defense and foreign policy issues did not cut in the electorate as they had previously. When the president raised taxes and broke his No New Taxes pledge from 1988, arguably the most central and conspicuous campaign pledge of his 30-year public career, that issue, that breadbasket of issues, was lost to the president. So he really almost had no choice in order to try to put that Reagan coalition together again, but to run on social issues. But at the end of the day, Reagan never did that. We wouldn't recommend doing that. We think those issues are important. We think that they belong as part of a cluster of issues. But they're not the central and fundamental rationale for Republican governance.
Let me ask you something that Pat Robertson said, and Pat Robertson founded the Christian Coalition, and you're the executive director of the Christian Coalition. He said he wants to see the GOP in the hands of pro-family Christians by 1996.
Well, I was at the banquet where he gave those remarks, and that quote is taken out of context. What he said in the next sentence was that he wanted to see a day when both major political parties were inclusive of our agenda and our issues.
But what are those issues? What is the agenda?
Well, the agenda is reducing the tax burden on the family. We see a situation, for example, where the tax burden on the family has gone up 2,000% since 1950. We'd like to see a day when parents could choose the school that their children attend. We'd like to see schools that work, streets that are safe. This is really the agenda. And, you know, we'd like to see a day, for example, where Bob Casey, the governor of Pennsylvania, is not excluded from speaking at the Democratic convention for no reason other than the fact that he's pro-life.
Where does the Christian Coalition come down on the issue of abortion?
Our position is that we think that an unborn baby has a right to legal protection. We think that we would allow for exceptions in the case of rape and incest and the life's mother being in danger if allowing those exceptions became necessary for the passage of a pro-life bill. We think that it is most likely that those legal changes are going to take place in the context of state legislatures and not in the context of federal legislation, and that's why we're opposed, for example, to the Kill Bill, which is also referred to as the Freedom of Choice Act, which would make it against the law for any state in America to restrict abortion, even for parental consent.
Let me ask you, Senator Chafee, as a member of the Republican Majority Coalition, which was founded in December, calling for a more moderate kind of Republican Party, the coalition calls for economic and fiscal conservatism as the defining principles of the GOP. What do you mean by that?
I think that what the principles of the Republican Party are, individual freedom, economic growth and opportunity, hopefully leading to more and better jobs, lower taxes, strong national defense, reducing the deficit, free trade, which hasn't been talked about. I think that's been one of the clarion calls that both Ronald Reagan and George Bush put out there. The North American Free Trade Agreement, I think, is a magnificent achievement. That's a defining difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. They are the party of protectionism that I believe is just going to caused tremendous harm, not just to this country, but to world peace. The expansion of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, bringing China into the family of nations. As you know, President Bush felt very strongly that China should be granted ordinary trade relationships that we grant to every country in the world, including Iraq, for example. We believe in keeping government out of our private lives, reaching goals by incentives, not by government decrees. That, of course, is going to come up in connection with the health care reform that we're going to be undertaking in this calendar year of 1993. So they're very, very different positions between the Republicans and the Democrats. But for the Republicans, if somebody is pro-life and wants to be in the Republican Party, three cheers. But I certainly don't think we want to keep out somebody who's pro-choice. And frankly, I think the matter now has been settled by the Supreme Court as far as the whole right to life or pro-choice arguments go, the abortion arguments go, and I just hope we can move on to other things and put that behind us.
Well,
the decision that was taken up by the Supreme Court pretty well settled it, and I think everybody's just had enough of this.
Well, I'm not quite done with it, so let me just ask you another question about it, though. The Republican Majority Coalition has called for the removal of the Republican Party's anti-abortion plank, which has been part of the platform since 1984. Do you see this, though, as a divisive issue still within the party?
Well, apparently it is. I've seen some statements by Mr. Reid and his group that say this is a sine qua non, absolutely has to be in there. This is the real guts of the Republican Party, and the fact of the matter is that two-thirds of the people in the country are opposed to that position. They are for the Democratic position, and they're certainly not for a very, very strong right-to-life plank, and indeed, to some degree, they're suggesting putting it into the Constitution. I don't believe in that, and if that's what is going to determine where the party's going to go, we're just going to lose an awful lot of people who believe in as we do in so many of the other facets that I've ticked off.
Let me reintroduce the both of you. And I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with Ralph Reed, who's the executive director of the Christian Coalition, Senator John Chafee, Republican from Rhode Island, a member of the Republican Majority Coalition. And we're talking about the Republican Party. Members of the Republican National Committee are meeting later this month to elect a new chairperson and also to talk about the direction the party should take after its recent defeat for the presidency. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Ralph Reed, executive director of the Christian Coalition, and John Chafee, senator from the state of Rhode Island, Republican senator from the state of Rhode Island. Let me ask you then, and I'll come to you, Senator Chafee, who do you want to lure back to the party? Senator Arlen Specter has been quoted as saying that he wants to bring back pro-choice Republican suburban women to the party. Who do you want to bring back?
Well, I want to bring back everybody. Who's out there? I'm not just seeking a 51-49 victory. I want big victories, so I want everybody we can get. And it's clear that the women were very, very put off by particularly what took place in the last election. George Bush had 50% of the women in his race in 1988, 1992. He had 37% of the women. So that's a very, very dramatic drop. Some of it due to the economy, but some of it, I'm convinced, is due to these other issues that were so accented. You know, one of the interesting things is that back to Ronald Reagan, who put together this coalition that was so successful. Ronald Reagan had the same views that many say we ought to make the core of the party. For instance, Ronald Reagan was pro-life. Ronald Reagan did believe in school prayer and things like that. But he did. He managed to have those positions, but not make them sort of a litmus test for being with him. He went on to other things. I noticed in his speech to the convention in Houston, Ronald Reagan never mentioned those issues.
Mr. Reed, who would you like to lure back to the party?
Well, I think the key to victory in 1980, 84, and 88, and the key for that matter to defeat, sadly, for the president in 1992, were the so-called Reagan Democrats. And those Reagan Democrats consist primarily of two main clusters. One is urban ethnic Catholics in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, particularly in big-ticket states like Michigan, Illinois, and Pennsylvania. And then the second key demographic cluster of the Reagan Democrats is Southern white Protestants in the South, and primarily evangelical, but also among a lot of the mainline denominations. And those people tended to come over to the Republican Party in the 80s under Reagan, based primarily on two sets of issues. One was the lower taxes issue, less government, lower taxes. And then the second issue was the pro-family, pro-life position of the Republican Party. And Senator Chafee is correct that President Bush did drop way off in his support among women from 88 to 92. But a sinking tide lowers all boats. Among evangelical Christians, for example, the president dropped from 80% to 55%. Among veterans, he dropped from about 70% to about 47%. He lost every category. So I don't think you can take just one demographic slice and say, well, that was the problem.
The Christian Coalition, as I understand it, is focusing more on state and local politics. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what inroads has your organization made in certain communities around the country?
Well, what we're encouraging people to do is to be good citizens, to go out there and exercise their right to vote, to get in contact with their elected officials at every level of government, and if they feel so led and qualified, to go out and file for office and run. It's really about good citizenship. But the point that we are making is that the old strategies that were adopted by the pro-family movement in the early 80s of trying to see an issue's agenda realized through a quadrennial rush at the White House is ultimately a failed strategy. The future for the issues that most Americans and most Christians care about, issues like crime, drugs, education, abortion, these are primarily dealt with at the school board and state legislative level. So that's really where the future is. I also think that this is a community that has been largely marginalized politically for three generations. I mean, as the African-American community moved into political power in the 60s and 70s and women in the 70s and 80s, this is a community that has yet to fully be included. And so I think whenever you're moving in that direction, you've got to start at the apprenticeship level. You've got to be good at being on a school board before you can be qualified to be a congressman. And so this is what we're encouraging people to do, to go out and exercise that civic responsibility and learn how to pull the levers of government and solve problems in their neighborhood and in their local community.
Mr. Reed, would you say the Republican Party is alive and well?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, people forget very quickly that in 1976, after Gerald Ford lost to Jimmy Carter, the political pundits and prognosticators of this country were writing the obituary of the Republican Party. And, of course, as it turned out, it was very premature because just 4 years later, the Republicans had gained control of the Senate for the first time since 1955 and had working control of the House of Representatives with the boll weevil conservative Democrats. So, you know, the fun thing about this business is it all eventually comes back around, and every victory is transitory and every defeat is transitory, and nothing's forever. So I think the key challenge for the Republican Party is the same challenge that I think faced Winston Churchill during the wilderness years of the 1930s. True, he was a backbencher, but he stood firm for what he believed in. He was willing to stand courageously and continue to articulate the values and the principles that had distinguished his career for 40 years. And then when it came time, when they really needed a leader, in a time of chaos and in a time of need, they turned to Winston Churchill. And I think that is what the Republican Party needs to do. This, by the way, is what the Democratic Party did. If you look at Bill Clinton's stance on the issues, he didn't retreat from civil rights, and he didn't retreat from their pro-abortion philosophy, and he didn't retreat from higher taxes and higher spending. So I think that it's not so much a matter of tinkering with the platform as much as it is being willing to stand up for what you believe in. But I personally think that most of the prognostication right now that would indicate that the Republican Party is flat on its back and is getting ready to go into fratricidal, holy war is just a lot of rubbish. I don't think there's going to be a lot of infighting. I don't think there's going to be nearly as much factional infighting as people are predicting.
Mr. Ralph Reed and Senator John Chafee, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ralph Reed is executive director of the Christian Coalition. Senator John Chafee is a Republican from Rhode Island and a member of the Republican Majority Coalition. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. The wounds that Louis Puller experienced in Vietnam profoundly affected his life. So did growing up the son of Chesty Puller, a military legend. Coming up, we'll talk with Louis Puller. He'll read from his Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Fortunate Son. Also, commentator Maureen Carrigan takes us back to 17th century New York, when it was still called New Amsterdam. It's the setting of the new mystery, The Dutchman, about Peter Stuyvesant's sheriff. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Somalia, U.S. Marines attacked and seized two heavy weapons storage compounds in the capital. They said that Somali gunmen inside have repeatedly fired at U.S. Army positions and have broken an agreement with their clan leader to keep heavy weapons off the streets. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from Mogadishu.
About 400 Marines, supported by tanks and helicopter gunships, first used loudspeakers to warn the gunmen inside that they faced overwhelming odds. When they refused to surrender their arms, the American assault force opened up with an awesome display of firepower. The Marine commander in Somalia, Major General Charles Wilhelm, said the gunmen had broken what he called the rules of the road, laid down by U.S. troops protecting famine relief efforts in Somalia. The assault did not, he said, mean a change in U.S. military strategy there.
It signals no change in our strategy whatsoever. We've approached each of our operations with the same basic philosophy. We will always go forward. We'll always provide the other side an opportunity to lay down their weapons. If they do not, they face dire consequences in the form of what we term very decisive force. That's what they were subjected to this morning. That is no change.
In Mogadishu, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
According to U.S. officials, Iraq has moved some of its surface-to-air missiles in southern Iraq, but they are still in a no-fly zone. Yesterday, Western allies told Iraq that the missiles had to be moved or there could be military retaliation. Meanwhile, Iraq has told Western allies at the UN today that while it rejects a no-fly zone, its UN ambassador has said he hopes that the crisis has now been defused. The Environmental Protection Agency has added secondhand smoke to its short list of substances known to cause cancer in human beings. The move could pave the way to more regulations to protect people from this common hazard. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
More than 425,000 people in the United States die each year from diseases caused by tobacco smoke. The EPA said today that another 3,000 bystanders, largely people who live with smokers, also die of lung cancer from breathing secondhand smoke. And hundreds of thousands of children each year get bronchitis, pneumonia, and other respiratory diseases from breathing their parents' smoke. The long-anticipated study drew immediate criticism from the tobacco industry, which said the science behind it is shaky. But the research has been reviewed thoroughly and approved by the EPA's independent science advisors. The EPA has no authority to regulate secondhand smoke, but Administrator William Riley said he hoped other agencies would use the report as a scientific basis for controlling this common air pollutant. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 36 points to close at 3,368.69 on volume of 303 million shares. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Rabin has now agreed to allow the International Red Cross to see more than 400 Palestinians stranded in southern Lebanon after being expelled from Israel. Earlier this week, UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali indicated that he would move to impose sanctions unless Israel showed greater flexibility in the current standoff. Palestinian diplomats have said that they will not continue Middle Eastern peace talks until the Palestinians are back in their homes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. According to the State Department, a 22-nation agreement to slow the spread of ballistic missiles has been strengthened. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Missile Technology Control Regime, or MTCR, was originally designed to curb the spread of missiles that can carry nuclear warheads. Under the new guidelines, missiles capable of delivering chemical and biological weapons are also covered. In effect, the new guidelines restrict the sale of a wider variety of missiles, including small ones, if there's reason to believe the country buying the missiles intends to use them for chemical or biological warfare. Iraq's threat to use Scuds with chemical warheads in the Gulf War convinced the U.S. and the 21 other Western nations in the MTCR to tighten the guidelines, according to State Department spokesman Richard Boucher. The MTCR cannot stop missile proliferation on its own, however. Several missile-exporting countries, such as North Korea, have refused to abide by it. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
According to officials in Paris, France was the most traveled-to spot for tourists last year. Government officials say more than 60 million visitors from other nations traveled to France in 1992, with the most coming from Germany, Britain, and Italy. The surplus of revenue between foreign tourists to France and French citizens traveling overseas came to $10.5 billion for a 13% increase last year compared to the year before. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The two major influences in Lewis Puller's early life were his father and the Vietnam War. Puller's memoir, Fortunate Son, is about his relationship with his father and his experiences fighting in Vietnam. He received a Pulitzer Prize last year for his book, which is now out in paperback. Puller's father was a much-decorated military hero. He got the name Chesty because he marched with his chest thrust out. He spent 30 years in the Marine Corps and retired in 1956 when Lewis Puller was still a boy. Lewis Puller joined the Marine Corps in 1967 and went off to fight in Vietnam. He was nearly blown to bits when he stepped on a landmine. He lost both his legs and parts of his hands. He returned to the States a bitter and angry man, unable to imagine living in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Puller works as a lawyer now for the Pentagon. When we spoke, he told me what it was like to have a father who was a hero.
He would walk into a crowded room, and the room would divide, and people would get quiet. We would go to Richmond, Virginia when I was a little boy, and strangers would come across the street to shake his hand. We'd go into restaurants and order meals and would not be allowed to pay for them. He was always, as long as I can remember, the center of attention.
Did you feel that you approached your father with some degree of deference then, knowing his stature in the community and actually around the nation?
I had, Marty, I had two fathers. I had my father, and I write about this in the book. I had this father who was a legend, and he was all powerful and didn't make mistakes and was fearless and was a water walker and the father with the medals and the great warrior. And then I had the father who was the caregiver and the nurturer and who shared my small triumphs and defeats and took care of me. And when I was smaller, I had a harder time separating those out, but I see clearly now that they were really two separate people and that the lesser-known one, the caregiver, was the one that that I really loved.
Did you feel then you had to share him with other people?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very definitely. When he went off to war during the Korean War, he never had enough time for us. His schedule was always busy while he was on active duty anyway. Later, after we got out of the Marine Corps, he had more time for us. And I got to know him better in that period between, say, 1956, when he retired from the Marine Corps, and in his old age.
You joined the Marine Corps in 1967. Being the son of Chesty Puller, did that pull any weight in the Marine Corps? Did that give you any special status whatsoever?
It made me a very singular lieutenant and a candidate before that. Certainly, everybody was watching every step that I took and every move that I make, and it was like living in a goldfish bowl stateside.
Mm-hmm.
After I got to Vietnam, it didn't make any difference. Once I got my platoon, all they cared about was having a competent lieutenant who wasn't going to get any of them killed.
I think one of one of your commanders, I guess this was in basic training, called you an irritant, that somehow your presence there would be considered an irritant. For whom, I wonder?
Probably for him. I don't know whether it generated any more paperwork for him or what have you, and he may have just been trying to hassle me. He was probably rather proud to have Chesty Puller's son in his platoon, but they never missed a chance to play mind games with you.
Describe what you saw as your plane landed in Vietnam, or even what you, as the door was opened, what even hit you then?
The incredible shimmering heat. It was like a slap in the face to come down onto the tarmac and feel that, I don't know what it was, 110 degrees, whatever. And it was humid, and I didn't think I'd ever get used to it. It was just absolutely oppressive.
As you came there, a green soldier, were you scared? Were you scared? Did you feel that you could handle this? Did you know what you were getting yourself into?
I was looking forward to it, in a way. I wanted to be tested. You know, I wanted to prove myself my father's son. But sure, I was scared. You know, I was getting ready to take over a platoon of young Marines who had been tested long before I got there, and many of them, it seemed to me from my particular vantage point then, far more capable than I was. As it turned out, that wasn't the case. I had the training that they didn't have, and I think I worked my way into leadership of the platoon pretty quickly without any ill effects.
What kind of a leader would you say you were, leader of your platoon?
I wasn't a hard-charging, you know, put the bayonet in the mouth and follow me kind of guy. I tried to be fair. I tried to be low-key. I tried to listen a lot at first. And eventually I got to the point where my main goal was to keep as many of them alive as I could.
Is that the ultimate goal of any leader then?
Probably not. I think the ultimate goal in that particular war was to kill the enemy. Body count was a big word. But after a while, I didn't care about killing the enemy. Certainly, you need some payback from time to time because of what they're doing to you. But my main concern was that my troops were being maimed and killed.
As the war went on, did you, and time went on, did you begin to feel more or less lucky? Because I would think there's a lot of kind of almost like superstitious behavior that you go through.
Yeah, what happens normally in Vietnam is that, or what happened in Vietnam was that a great many more troops would get wounded in their first month and in their last month. They'd get wounded in their first month because they didn't know what they were doing, and they'd get wounded in their last month because they'd gotten too cautious. Superstition, I don't know. I began to see after a while so many of us were getting wounded that I thought that inevitably it was going to happen to me. I didn't have any idea that what the dimensions would be or the severity or the degree, but I thought I would get wounded.
My guest is Lewis Puller, author of Fortunate Son. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking today with Lewis Puller Jr., and his book is called Fortunate Son, The Healing of a Vietnam Vet. And he served in Vietnam, was wounded there, and actually came back to Philadelphia, to the Philadelphia Naval Base, to recuperate, and now lives and works in Washington, D.C. I'd like to have you read this section.
Sure.
Right there.
A narrow trail led up the hill to the headquarters group, and as I approached, it never occurred to me that the 30 meters between my course and the commander's position had not been secured. I knew only that the firepower advantage of the NVA squad I had just encountered would be neutralized if I could reach the men milling at the crest of the hill. With only a few meters left to cover in my flight, a thunderous boom suddenly rent the air, and I was propelled upward with the acrid smell of cordite in my nostrils. When I landed a few feet up the trail from the booby-trapped howitzer round that I had detonated, I felt as if I had been airborne forever. Colors and sounds became muted, and although there was now a beehive of activity around me, all movement seemed to me to be in slow motion. I thought initially that the loss of my glasses in the explosion accounted for my blurred vision, and I had no idea that the pink mist that engulfed me had been caused by the vaporization of most of my right and left legs. As shock began to numb my body, I could see through a haze of pain that my right thumb and little finger were missing, as was most of my left hand, and I could smell the charred flesh, which extended from my right wrist upward to the elbow. I knew that I had finished serving my time in the hell of Vietnam. As I drifted in and out of consciousness, I felt elated at the prospect of relinquishing my command and going home to my wife and unborn child. I did not understand why Watson, who was the first man to reach me, kept screaming, "Pray, Lieutenant, for God's sake, pray." I could not see the jagged shards of flesh and bone that had only moments before been my legs, and I did not realize until much later that I had been forever set apart from the rest of humanity.
What happened to you?
I thought my war was over, and it was just beginning. I thought that in giving up my legs, that and certainly it wasn't a voluntary act, but I thought that that my time in Vietnam and in the theater of war was over, and that I no longer would have the awesome responsibility of being responsible for 28 or 29 young Americans on a daily basis. For that reason, I was elated, mm-hmm. actually. But I did not see that it was going to take an enormous struggle just to try to come to terms with what had happened to me physically and psychologically and spiritually.
When did it become clear to you the extent of your injuries?
I certainly didn't know when I plummeted into the sand that day what had happened to me. You know, I could see that I was missing a part of a thumb and part of a finger on my right hand. I didn't know that my legs were gone. I don't know when that occurred. I think that if it had occurred at that moment, that life probably would have been taken from me. A lot of troops in Vietnam, when they saw potentially life-threatening injuries, just gave up and died. So maybe for some reason when my shoulder was dislocated and I couldn't turn my head to see my legs, maybe there was a divine providence that willed that it would be that way.
Was there pain even at that instant?
I went into shock pretty quickly. And shock is a wonderful way of taking care of pain.
You spent some time here in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital.
Yeah, Marty, I spent 2 years in the Philadelphia Naval Hospital.
I wondered how accessible the world was back in the late 60s and how easy or difficult it was to just get from here to there if you're going to be in a wheelchair.
It was terribly difficult. It's not easy now, mm-hmm. but back then it was frustrating as hell to get out and you know, I went from being a lieutenant in the Marine Corps, you know, young and dumb, and we've got an expression for it that I can't repeat over the air, but I virtually had the power of lightning and thunder at my fingertips. I could call in artillery missions. I could make lightning and thunder. I could rain death and destruction on people. I could give orders, and people would obey them almost instantly. And I went from that, just in the space of a few seconds, to being totally helpless, to having to ask for a drink of water, or if my nose itched, I had to ask somebody else to scratch it. I couldn't feed myself. I couldn't turn over in bed. I couldn't be responsible for any of the daily functions that I had taken for granted for the first 23 years of my life. It was a harrowing, degrading experience.
How was your family able to handle it?
My wife, God bless her, was you know, the stiff upper lip. You know, she stuck her jaw out and stayed with me right from the beginning, and has never faltered. You know, her love and her loyalty's always been there, you know, even at times when I have been unworthy of it. And It's gotten me through some awfully rough and rocky spots.
And for your father?
Difficult. I only saw him cry twice in my life. You know, once, and I write about this in the book, and once before I went to Vietnam, and once when I got back. And the first time I saw him cry, I didn't understand what was happening. You know, I'd lived with him for 22 years, and I'd never seen a tear come out of his eye. And here I was in the backyard of my family home beneath a willow tree, and my father is trying to tell me to come back on my shield or with honor, which was an expression that I guess Spartan mothers told their sons back in the Peloponnesian Wars or whatever, and he was very proud of it. And he couldn't say it, and he choked on the words, and then he broke. And then I got back from the war, of course, and when he saw me, he was an absolute mess. One of the, and again, I stress that this is a happy book, but one of the sad things about the book is that he and I were never able to sit down and reconcile what had happened to me and how my injuries had affected him, and there was none of the natural playing out that should have taken place, that should have contributed to the healing. He had a series of strokes right after I got back, and each one left him with a progressive inability to communicate until finally there was virtually nothing left.
Could he hear?
I don't think so. Oh. And at the end, he was also blind, and there was really no communication. While that is just inordinately sad to see a man who was so strong become so weak, it's part of life. You know, it's eventually what happens to all of us. And I think the description of that in the book, of his decline and his illness and ultimately his death, and while it was the hardest part of the book to write for me, is the most beautiful part of the book.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty.
Lewis Puller's memoir, Fortunate Son, received a Pulitzer Prize last year. It's now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air. Let me fill you in on some of the stories coming up on today's edition of All Things Considered. More on the ultimatum from the U.S. and its allies for Iraq to withdraw its missiles from the southern no-fly zone. President-elect Clinton met today with members of his economic team. Elizabeth Arnold will have a report. Linda Gradstein reports from the Middle East on Red Cross and UN efforts to resolve the fate of 415 Palestinians expelled weeks ago from the West Bank and Gaza. And a new recording features opera with a twist, karaoke opera, Amy Sallet reports. That and more coming up on All Things Considered. In this post-holiday season, if you're looking for a mental getaway, commentator Maureen Carrigan recommends a mysterious journey to 17th century New Amsterdam.
Over the past 6 months, I've read hard-boiled mysteries starring female, gay, lesbian, African-American, and Native American private eyes. I've also read thrillers featuring gumshoes who are nuns, priests, rabbis and monks, jockeys, antique dealers, sewer workers, and even a couple of cats. In this crowd, Detective Peter Toneman looks like a throwback. I mean a real throwback. Not only is he white, straight, and male, but the mean streets he walks down are paved with oyster shells. The Dutchman is a new mystery set in the year 1664 in New Amsterdam. Toneman is the colony's sheriff. In Dutch, he's called a schout, and he displays most of the personality flaws that we've come to associate with the hard-boiled private eye. He drinks too much, brandy wine instead of whiskey. He has trouble with authority figures, in this case his Calvinist boss, Peter Stuyvesant. And he has a weakness for good-looking dames, particularly a young Jewish woman named Raquel Mendoza, whose estranged husband Benjamin has disappeared under odd circumstances. The Dutchman was written by a husband and wife team, Martin and Annette Myers. Annette Myers claims she got the idea for the book one morning when the apparition of a heavy-set man wearing breeches and a cudgel materialized in her New York apartment. After digging around in archives, she identified the ghost as Peter Toneman, who really was once the sheriff of New Amsterdam. Personally, I believe her story. Toneman seems tough enough to fight his way back from the great beyond. The historical research that the Myers team subsequently did gives the Dutchman a rich, moldy atmosphere. We learn all sorts of peculiar details here about New Amsterdam and the nearby settlements of Brooklyn and Pavonia, now known prosaically as New Jersey. Toneman's town is a place where pigs run wild down the Broadway, where con men lure the innocent into a primitive version of three-card Monte called Find the Pellet, and where the gallows casts its grim shadow somewhere down around what's now known as Wall Street. New Amsterdam, on Toneman's watch, is also being battered by a crime wave. First, the tavern keeper, Hendrik Smit, commits suicide, or does he? Then, the Mendoza's house is burned down, and a charred corpse is discovered in its ruins. Still another corpse turns up, this one hiding a secret message in its empty eye socket. And there's one more little problem. British warships have just sailed into the harbor, and New Amsterdam is one cannon blast away from becoming New York. The Myers plan to follow up the Dutchman with future mysteries that trace the adventures of Toneman's descendants. That's okay, but I wish they'd reconsider and write more mysteries involving the lumbering, likable Toneman. He sticks with you. When I was in New York during the holidays, I kept thinking about him and wondering about the old secrets and old bones buried deep beneath the city's streets.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Dutchman by Martin and Annette Myers. Fresh Air was produced today by Danny Miller, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, the ways and means of the 103rd Congress. The group of legislators voted into the House and Senate last November is the most diverse yet. Journalist Steve Roberts will tell us what to expect. Also, a look back at Head Start with Edward Ziegler, one of its founders. I'm Marty Moscowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.